So it's a particular pleasure to be talking to you, Tony Wrigley, who I was thinking the other day, perhaps of the four people who've most influenced me in my work, Tony is certainly among the four, with along with Jack Goody and one or two others. So, Tony, when were you born and where were you born?
I was born in 1931 in the middle of Manchester, Chawton cum Hardy, though I remember nothing of it because my parents moved when I was, I think, one, very young anyway.
And tell me something about your parents or your grandparents, however far back you like to go.
My paternal grandfather and my father were both Unitarian ministers. My maternal grandfather had been born in North Moulton in Devonshire, and I think probably failed to get anywhere to work as an agricultural labourer and moved to Rugeley in Staffordshire and became a coal miner in Cannock Chase.
And then going down to your parents' generation, what did your father do?
He too was a Unitarian minister, moving round churches in Lancashire and Cheshire. My mother had been a teacher before they married, but we're going back so far in her case that on marriage she had to cease. You couldn't be both married and a teacher as a woman at that
Really?
time.
Good heavens.
Though she resumed it when my father died. He died relatively young in his early 60s. And she then returned, I think in fact returning to teaching in a way helped her greatly because it distracted her from the distress of having lost her husband relatively young.
Tell me something about the character and of your parents and how that influenced them, you or their ideas. I mean, did Unitarian ministry influence your life, do you think?
Oh, I'm sure it did, yes. I would, although I haven't for some years attended the Unitarian Church in Cambridge, I'm a trustee of it. And my take, so to speak, on Christianity is very much that formed by a Unitarian background, I think. And I've continued to read with interest something of the lives of the prominent Unitarians in places like Manchester and Birmingham and Liverpool during the 19th century, when many of them formed a sort of urban elite, and I think we're facing the problem of reconciling Orthodox Christianity with the kind of disruption introduced by, above all, Charles Darwin into thinking about religion and matters related to it and the relationship between religion and science. So much of that, although absorbed unconsciously, was influential with me. I perhaps should have said that I'm sure that one could make a good deal out of the fact that both my brother and I spent 3.5 years as evacuees in North Wales during the war, so we were separated from our parents in middle childhood, in my case from 9 to 12 or 13. And I've no doubt that makes a big difference to the nature of your relationship with your parents. Very valuable in some ways, but a bit traumatic in others.
I imagine. And what about your mother's character? Did that influence you a lot?
Yes, I think she was ambitious for her children, and no, again, in retrospect, probably pushed me in an academic direction. Maybe didn't have to push very hard, but she was. Whereas I think many parents with working class, many children with working class parents face the problem that one or both of them is emotionally hostile to orthodox academic attainment. She was at the opposite end of the spectrum, as you would expect, given her.
And your father as well. I mean, you're both sympathetic to that idea.
Yes, though he was less. He was hands off. He would not have pushed anyone in any particular direction, I think. Whereas she, I think, was firm in that regard.
What's the first significant school that you remember attending? Was that in Wales or before that?
The situation in Wales was curious in a way. I think it was normal that if there were very few evacuees in the district, then he went to the local Welsh school, which is what happened to me for an initial period. And then as the numbers built up of evacuees, you'd form a separate school for English children, in this case in the vestry of one of the local churches, chapels, I should say, where children, where a single teacher, poor woman, had to look after a very diverse group of Liverpudlian kids who were aged, I think, between 6 and 14.
Liverpudlian?
Yes.
But you were from Manchester, you said?
No, but my parents by then had moved to Liverpool.
Yeah.
And Liverpool got quite severely bombed. That was the reason we were evacuated.
Mm. Then where do you move to school after that?
Well, I suppose the formative period was after my father had moved to two Unitarian church chapels, Dean Rowan style, and we were living in Wilmslow.
Yes.
And I went to King's School, Macclesfield.
Yeah.
Which is where I did what was then school certificate and higher school certificate, long before O and A levels came in.
Yes.
And it was a monolithic sort of school, a very conservative, Protestant kind of establishment. The headmaster of the day, who was a remarkable man named Shaw, used to...
Is that S-H-A-W?
S-H-A-W, yes, T.T. Shaw, who I think had on appointment been the youngest headmaster in the headmaster's conference.
Hmm.
And he, I discovered later, because my brother later taught at that school, was in fact quite left-wing in his views, but his performance on speech day in pandering to the prejudices of his audience was remarkable. He used to say, this school prides itself on producing a robust kind of boy, which went down very well with the parents.
Were there any teachers there, apart from Mr. Shaw, who kindled your interest in anything?
Shaw didn't have any. I had no or almost no direct contact with him, and not all of that very agreeable.
Mm.
But the history teacher, a man named Clark, Ron Clark, probably did, I think, have a big influence on me, and I kept in intermittent contact with him up to his death, which occurred only 3 or 4 years ago, very recently.
What was his special area of interest, or did he cover the whole of history?
I can't remember that he had any particular interest, and his teaching technique was such that I gather he was criticised by the school inspectors when they came round, but it was very effective nonetheless.
Do you remember what that technique was? I mean, it was...
Yes, he was quite happy. It does sound rather dull. He was quite happy to give quite a lot of material in the form of dictated notes, but he had the kind of personality to make a very big impression. And I think, in retrospect, that his personality in turn had been much influenced by his experience during the war. He was a transport officer, and I think one of the first men into Belsen. And although he only ever once, that I can remember, talked about his wartime experiences, I do think they probably gave him a very different take than he might otherwise have given. On history and its blacker side.
Hmm. Was this the time that were you beginning to move towards particular interests and disciplines at this point?
I was frustrated because the school obliged post-O-level boys either to be modern or scientific. I wanted to continue to do mathematics, and I continue to regret the missed couple of years. I think my father even appealed to the headmaster because I felt so strongly about it, but got no joy out of them. The other subject that really did also equally interest me was geography.
Mm.
And in fact, when I became an undergraduate in Cambridge, I read both parts of the History Tripos and then part two of the Geography Tripos. And I think having a foot in both camps has been formative in many ways.
Hmm. But you would like to have been a mathematician? Yeah.
Not to have been a mathematician, but I found mathematics fascinating and have dabbled with some aspects of statistical work more recently, and I'm sure would have found it a great asset to have been more at home in formal mathematics than I was.
Was it, you mentioned Cambridge, was this the only university you applied to, or did you...
I got here by accident. I wanted to go to Oxford. And the school, someone at the school, I can't remember who, suggested that, and as you probably will remember, in those days it was normal if you wanted to go on to attempt Oxbridge to do it in a third year. And someone advised me to take a kind of practice run at the same point, the fourth term rather than the seventh term, and to do it at Cambridge so that I'd see both places. And having had the offer of a minor scholarship on the basis of this, I went to Peterhouse, which was very strong in history at that time, rather than attempting Oxford the following year.
So you didn't have a gap year or anything, and you went up quite young, or...?
I was, yes, 18 and 1 month, I suppose, when I went up.
So you went to Peterhouse, and who were your undergraduate teachers?
Brian Wormald and Dennis Mac-Smith, principally. Both of whom, I think, had quite a strong influence on me, though I didn't always agree with them. But they were conscientious, interesting people. And the fact that the college also had at that time Herbert Butterfield, David Knowles, Munir Poston and Hugh Brogan, not Hugh, Dennis Brogan as professors, meant that as I grew older I had contact with a wide range of different kind of historians.
Were you beginning to get interested in a special part of history as an undergraduate, or was it all...?
Well, I knew I was always much more attracted to economic history than to other branches, and when the time came to decide whether or not to go on and do a postgraduate work, I think my dual background in history and geography was very influential. I became conscious, I think, because of the work I did in geography, that the very often unquestioned assumptions on the part of economic historians that the natural unit to use was the nation state was debatable. And I knew, and it occurred to me that I could combine that with my interest in economic history by looking at the belt of areas that industrialised from northern France through central Belgium, the Arkham coalfield area to the Ruhr, and to see whether the conventional histories, which would tend to talk about the German technical education system or the French banking system or something as helping to explain why industry developed in a particular way in France and or Germany or Belgium, whether they were more adequate as explanations than looking at the belt as a whole and testing whether their membership of three different countries made much difference. And partly because of that, managed to arrange to spend a first year of graduate work away from Cambridge with the Committee on Social Thought in Chicago, which I wanted to go to because its head was John Neff, who was perhaps then the most distinguished economic historian in the United States. In any case, was also very interested in in fact, is known in this country largely for his work on the coal industry, though I think that's a rather distorted view of his range of interests. In fact, I didn't see very much of Neff when I went to Chicago, because between fixing up to go there and getting there, his first wife died, and he was profoundly affected by it, and I saw him face to face only on three or four occasions. Though I did, he did give one seminar series, lecture series, on the essence of which was how civilization had reached its high point in 13th century France and been running downhill ever since, which is not the sort of idea that topic that people would associate with him. But there were many other people, including Hayek, who was then with the Committee on Social Thought in Chicago at the time, who had a great influence on me.
Did Hayek had quite an influence on you?
Yes, Hayek gave each, I think the system was that each of the grand panjandrums gave lecture series. Mm. He gave a fascinating series on Mandeville's Fable of the Bees, which I still remember quite clearly.
Mm.
And there was an art historian called Blankenhagen who was very approachable and interesting and forthcoming. And the library there was a revelation. In fact, when I came back to this country and tried to find similar things in the university library, it was intensely frustrating.
Mm.
The university library does have the advantages that go with being a copyright library, but its holding of secondary literature, secondary French, Belgian and German 19th century historical literature was miserable. And ironically, the whole thing, the Chicago Library was established in the 1890s, I think, but they had much fuller coverage.
Who was your official supervisor for this?
Initially, Munir Postum, an extraordinary man, and very stimulating, if occasionally erratic. But as I became more interested in demographic matters, I can't remember whether it was on his suggestion or mine or someone else's, I spent the last year or 18 months with David Glass at LSE. Yeah.
Returning to Poston, you said he was an extraordinary man. In what way particularly was he extraordinary? I mean, he had a huge breadth of knowledge and double interests in medieval and modern history and so on. But
and he was what I think is a rarity amongst purely English scholars. He was not only continental in origin, but continental in the way in which he thought about many issues, and in his acquaintance with the literature of other major European countries. Not just their literature, but their style of thinking. So being exposed to Munir gave you a different worldview, I think, than those that you would have got from equally distinguished but purely Anglo-centric characters. And he had the ability to make penetrating and interesting, if sometimes oddball, comments on almost any thesis that was put to him, as you could well see in the seminar series that he used to conduct.
And what about David Glass? I was lectured by him, and knew people who worked with him, who found him both brilliant but sometimes a bit difficult.
He too, in a sense, was very continental in his thinking. And he was technically very able. I should perhaps digress to say that the reason I got into this demographic, became more interested in population matters, was that I found it frustrating in working on material from the three countries I mentioned, that what I'd assumed would be easy to do, which was to build up comparable banks of data on each of the three countries, proved irritatingly difficult because many of the series were constructed on different bases. I mean, for example, coal price series, I've forgotten which way it rounds, but coal price series in Belgium, let's say, would be pithead prices, and coal price series in France were market prices. And of course, they greatly differ, but not because they're really different, but because they were collected on a different basis. In addition to which, many countries in the course of the 19th century introduced different breaks in the series. And one of the very few things that isn't subject to that difficulty, or much less subject to it, is information about population and population change. And I hit upon what I thought were viable ways of measuring some aspects of social and economic change in each of these areas, making use of population data. But that does take you into an area where a different range of techniques is needed. And Glass turned to and had himself worked on, not just on this country.
Mm. This was, what year are we now reaching, 1950s?
I came up as an undergraduate in 49,
mm.
started as a PhD student in 53, and it ran through, I think, to 57
mm.
when I took the degree.
What was the sort of general conclusion of your PhD on the coal industry?
That both the nature and the speed of change, well, I should preface it by saying that very clearly Belgium was the area, the Sambre-Meuse Valley was the area which was quickest to adopt technical innovations from England, and therefore in the early years, in the 1830s and 40s, Belgian coal production, steel production, textile manufacture was in advance of the other areas that I mentioned, the extensions east and west. But by the end of the 19th century, I thought it was clear that you could show that the course of development and the problems that were experienced in some areas and the very rapid growth that took place elsewhere was very largely a function of the nature and quality of the coal resources in the different areas. So that the Ruhr, for example, had massive advantages which would have shown through independent of the country divisions between them. So if you want to understand developments through the field as a whole, which I dubbed the Austrasian field, you could do so most easily by largely ignoring national differences.
But there has been this, I mean, one of the great questions is why coal was developed so fast in a large scale in England, not in many parts of Germany and Belgium, and also not in, after an early start in China, and not in Japan. I mean, the non-development of coal, which has been addressed by quite a lot of people in these different places, where do you usually start to look for an explanation of why this should happen?
Well, part of it is geological. Until the development of the steam engine made deep drainage feasible, what they call concealed coal fields that are overlain by a large amount of later geological material, are inaccessible. And most of the really big coal fields are concealed fields, so that the great bulk of the Ruhr, for example, would have been inaccessible, even though it existed. So it's partly that. But the right way to look at the presence of coal, for example, in relation to China, I think, is that the absence of coal will prohibit the kind of growth that we think of as taking place in the Industrial Revolution. Its presence doesn't guarantee it will happen. It needs a combination of other factors, which, as it happened, largely were English. But of course, once you've shown the significant, once other countries become aware of the extraordinary, the new type of economic growth that's feasible, if you switch to inanimate sources of energy, they'll copy it very quickly and sometimes outpace the people who innovate originally.
So it's a necessary but certainly not sufficient
yes.
cause. You mentioned there the other factors that are needed, and you speculated quite a lot on that over time, particularly in relation to England. What are the some of the other bundle of features that led England to be the first industrial society?
Well, the way I would couch it, I think, is to look at the concept of income elasticity of demand. It's conventional in economics, and I think is a defensible generalization, that as real incomes rise, the rate at which the demand for primary product, for certain basic products, grows will be slower than the growth of demand for manufactured goods and later for services. In the absence of demand, you won't get production. If the level of real incomes remains low, the scale of aggregate demand for things other than food, clothing, housing and fuel will remain minimal, and you just don't have the basis for the kind of expansion that took place in the Industrial Revolution. Therefore, one of the necessary prerequisites is an increase in disposable incomes, and therefore a change in the structure of aggregate demand. And if that's to take place, since in every country prior to the Industrial Revolution, agriculture is overwhelmingly the largest producer, it's a virtual necessity that you must find some way of increasing output per head in agriculture, which has the dual effect of increasing real incomes and of releasing labour to undertake other kinds of tasks. What happened in England was that the feedback between increasing agricultural efficiency, increasing efficiency within the organic economy, and the growth of cities, and the two I think are very intimately related, which long antedates the conventional Industrial Revolution and seems to have been taking place largely from some point in the 16th century to the middle of the 18th century, did create a situation in which by 1750 about half of the male labour force was no longer working on the land, whereas almost universally in other organic economies the comparable percentages, 80%, 70, 80, even 85 or 90%. And the extraordinarily rapid growth of London that made it the largest city in Europe by the middle of the 17th century is helpful, or is part of the feedback process. It, without the existence of a large urban demand, even if the capacity to increase agricultural production is present, there's no incentive to do so. If agriculture is largely organised around the self-sufficiency of peasant farmers, they have no reason to change. If you have a rapidly growing urban market, there's a strong incentive to change, and the development of the landlord-farmer agricultural labour structure in England is very closely linked to its increasing urbanisation. Once that's happened, then if you're fortunate enough also to be to have ready access to coal and an increasing demand for initially heat energy in the forms of production for which the change in the structure of aggregate demand is creating a rapidly growing market, then you have the possibility of the kinds of changes that then took place. There has been, as perhaps you know, very recently there is coming to existence a group of people from England, from Sweden, from Spain, Portugal, Italy, Germany and the Netherlands, all of whom are collaborating in trying to trace the history of energy production and energy usage in the countries that I've mentioned from an earlier date as possible. What that shows, interestingly, is a lot of very interesting things, but the point to which I'd like to draw attention is that it's demonstrable that already before the end of the 16th century, more than half of all the energy that was used in this country was came from coal. You don't reach that situation anywhere else in Europe until into the 19th century. By the middle of the 18th century, and again, well before at the beginning of the period that's conventionally called the Industrial Revolution, it is already a largely coal-based economy. Coal is a very prominent part of the English economy. And it's fairly easy to use coal rather than wood in all kinds of production that depend upon heat energy, although there was technical barriers to be overcome, particularly in relation to iron production. But the big breakthrough is when you can also transform the heat energy in coal into mechanical energy to drive machines, and then in effect the productive power of individuals is very greatly changed. And at the same time, the point about an organic economy is that there is a necessary limit to the scale of production because of the nature of all pre-industrial economies. It's been estimated that the energy contained in incident sunlight falling on Britain in an average year is the equivalent of 20,000 million tons of coal, a colossal amount of energy. And one might think that makes it possible for an organic economy to expand indefinitely. The snag is that the only way in which that's converted into a form in which it's of use to man or any other living creature is photosynthesis, which is a very inefficient process and captures characteristically somewhere between a tenth and four-tenths of 1% of the incident energy coming in through incident sunlight, which in turn means, if you do the arithmetic, that even theoretically, the quantity of energy that's available in any organic economy is, well, the best guess is around 20 million, because a lot of the photosynthesis creates vegetation which is not directly used by men, but by human beings, but by animals and insects and birds and so on. And that in turn means that it's literally physically impossible to create production on the scale that we've become accustomed to. And that the only way around that restriction is to tap fossil fuels, which themselves represent the energy stored in plants over tens of millions of years. So we live on, so as I mentioned once in an article that got published quite obscurely, the capitalist revolution that really matters is the capital that's locked up in fuel, non-inorganic fuels. And the belief that a capitalist system, so to speak, or moving to a capitalist system automatically gives it the capacity to grow indefinitely is misleading, for the same reason that believing that the presence of coal automatically gives you that capacity. It's a combination of things that make it feasible. And I think the work, the book that Jan de Vries and Ad van der Woude published, initially in Dutch, which has come out in English as The First Modern Economy, is interesting for a number of different ways. Early modern Dutch economic history is full of much that's instructive generally. But one of the things they say explicitly, they believe their book demonstrates, is that the creation of a capitalist economic system, which they believe had come about in Holland earlier than anywhere else, as I think Adam Smith would agree, does not guarantee exponential growth. It may enable you to reach a higher plateau than you would otherwise have reached, but it's other factors that enable you to get off the plateau.
Fascinating. Just one, so many things I'd like to follow up there, but just one on, you mentioned that the productive technologies in agriculture must be improved so that you have, what are the role of animals in this?
I think major, though I wish I knew, I could speak with more confidence about it.
Is England different in its
relation? Well, I think the at bottom it's again a matter of energy. There are forms of production like rice cultivation in much of Asia, and I think probably potato cultivation in pre-famine Ireland, where you can produce enough food to feed yourself and your family without significant energy inputs from draft animals. It so happens that the kind of agriculture in which you're dependent on grains like wheat or barley, that's not true. I once got quite interested in the early history of settlement in Australia. One of the fascinating things about that is that they found it impossible to get draft animals alive to Australia for, or strictly speaking, some arrived but were lost by careless conquerors. And therefore they had to revert to hoe agriculture. And you can't feed yourself with hoe agriculture if you're using European grains. And so what the home government had hoped would be an economy measure, getting rid of convicts who would then feed themselves, proved delusion. It's much more oversimplifying. But because of this sort of issue, one of the key variables in determining what levels of output per head you can reach is the ratio of draft animals to farmers. And it helps to live in a country like England in which the climate and the soils provide plenty of opportunities for grazing for animals. And if you can strike a balance between population and surface area that enables you to maintain a large stock of draft animals, and more particularly if you can find forms of rotational agriculture which include the possibility, in fact a hinge upon including clover and lucerne and other crops of that kind in the rotation, you have a double benefit. It increases the nitrogen content of the soil in the rotation, but it also provides fodder for a large number of animals. Not just draft animals, plenty of sheep too, so you can maintain a big woolen industry. But I think work that was done in Mexico that I came across in, I think, the 1930s, where there was land that was both cultivated by hand and other areas that were cultivated with draft animals, suggests that the human equivalent of a horse is about 6 men. So what work that would otherwise need, say, 5 or 6 men to perform can be performed by one man if he has a horse to help him. And that comes in very important in certain aspects of English agriculture, like the use of if you convert it into ton miles that need to be performed, then if you're going to make extensive use of materials that improve the quality of the soil, both manure and other things, then it's only feasible if you have draft animals to help you, because moving huge quantities of very heavy materials in any other way is virtually impossible. Again, if you look at prints of the very early years of settlement in Australia, you can see logs being drawn on a wagon yoked to 20 or 30 men, which looks like merciless exploitation of human labour. But if you don't have draft animals, it's that or nothing. And the ability to cultivate to a high standard is often closely linked with a relatively good ratio of draft animals to people. And you get double benefits, or I think you did in England. If you can feed animals well, they reach maturity much more quickly. So for any given stock of beef cattle, for example, the number that you can kill in each year is much higher if they are well fed, because it takes fewer years for them to reach maturity. And they will actually be bigger than they would have been if you've fed them. You get more meat per animal. So you get feedback benefits there too.
Let's come back to your life and career, because you've just finished your PhD in the 50s. What did you then do? What was, did you move into a job straight away?
Yes. I became an assistant lecturer in the geography department, I think, in 1957.
And then in Cambridge?
In Cambridge, and then a lectureship, which continued to the middle 70s. I also was elected as a fellow at Peterhouse and spent 10 years as bursar there from 64 to 74, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I found the, it really is true that a rest is as good, a change is as good as a rest. The very different range of things that's involved in being a bursar from being an academic is instructive and enjoyable. And indeed, amongst other things, visiting college farms is instructive, even in relation to agricultural development. And remember being struck in talking to some of the bigger farmers who are farming, let's say, 1,000 acres or so, by them saying they rent large amounts of land, and I was interested in why they rented rather than buying. It's, in effect, their answer amounted to saying it's quite clear that it's a better use of capital to own a small fraction, 200 or 300 acres, within a portfolio of 1,000 and rent the rest, because you can make more effective use of your capital resources by that combination than you would if you tied it all up in land ownership, which again is interesting given the apparently astonishing emotional value in a peasant society of actually owning the land. It's, England had long become very different in that respect. Those sort of things come home to you actually in doing a different sort of job. And then, I suppose, to complete an intellectual autobiography, I for some years was jointly with Peter Laslett. Well, we'd founded the Cambridge Group for the History of Population and Social Structure in 1964, and I became entirely, I was paid as a director of it directly by the then SSRC for, forgotten exactly how long, but much of the 1970s. Was phoned by Ralph Dahrendorf, actually when I was in sabbatical term in Holland, in, must have been 79, to say that the school, LSE, had decided, in fact really following a review after Glass's death, to create a separate demographic unit. Would I like to head it? And I went there in 79 and stayed for 9 years at LSE doing that.
You enjoy that?
Very much, and I take some pride in the fact that two of my first appointments are now fellows of the Academy, which is quite...
Who are they?
Mike Murphy, who is, so to speak, a demographer's demographer, and...
It doesn't matter.
See you in a moment.
Come back later.
Wait a minute.
And
Tim Dyson, whom you would know,
yes, I
think, well, because of
Malthus
and his and well, his interest in India must overlap with yours in Nepal. We had a very good teaching program, I think, which was largely focused on the master's degree, where the overwhelming bulk of the students came from other countries, which again was very interesting to me. That's one of the reasons LSE is interesting as a place. And one of the things that I found quite interesting while I was there was that at some point during my period there, the I suppose under Thatcherite urgings, universities were obliged to charge, if I remember it correctly, the full average cost of graduate work to foreign students. And the net effect of that in LSE, I'm sure someone could correct my percentages, but I think broadly speaking it had the effect of reducing the proportion of the income of the school that came one way and another from the British government from 80% to 40% in a very few years, because such a high proportion of all the students came from overseas. And that in turn meant that the LSE began to operate in effect like a private school would in the States. Its income really depended as much on the cross rate between the dollar and the pound as it did on anything else. If the pound was cheap, lots and lots of students came. If the pound was expensive, they went to Princeton or somewhere in the States.
Can we just go back to the Cambridge group a little bit? Well, first of all, the French influence. I mean, I first came across your work in 1965, when I suddenly heard about family reconstitution and your work on Colleton. How did you get involved in family reconstitution? And what is family reconstitution?
It's a technique for connecting up the series of vital events that take place in anyone's life, birth, marriage, death, so that you can reconstruct family histories. Now, as a technique, it goes back much earlier. Swedish scholars were practicing reconstitution early in the 20th century. But the key technical development that's due to French scholar Louis Henry is to refine it in an important respect. Henry was recruited to INED by Alfred Sauvy, I think, who was its early director. INED in turn had been created by de Gaulle, who was fond of talking about the importance of La France de 100 millions. And Henri was deputed by Sauvy to look into the fundamental characteristics of human fertility, since indirectly that might have a bearing on government policy. And he was frustrated by the fact that those countries, we're talking about the early 50s, which had very good demographic information, records, took censuses and vital statistics, were uniformly countries in which there was already a lot of artificial control of fertility. And those countries in which there was little or no control of fertility didn't have good statistics. And he came across, I don't know just how, the work that had been done on the bourgeoisie of Geneva, the biographies of individual bourgeois, members of the bourgeoisie, had been compiled from the late 16th century, I think, onwards, and gave Henri the possibility of studying the characteristics of fertility that he found important. Slightly to his dismay, however, they were amongst the groups earliest into family limitation, which becomes a feature of Genevan bourgeois life by the middle years of the 17th century. So he still wanted more data, and he turned to French parish registers to see whether you could create the same thing for whole communities that had been done for the Genevan bourgeoisie and proved feasible. I can't remember when I first read his work, but I found it very interesting and wanted to see whether it was possible to parallel that using English parish registers. David Glass had himself tried this and then concluded it wasn't possible. He didn't do the work himself, he got someone else to do the work, but thought that the English material was not sufficiently detailed. I tried it on Colleton.
Why Colleton?
Because, well, the number of English parishes which have continuous registration from an early date is limited. And what was attractive about Colleton is that it had both periods when registration was very full, comparable to those in French parish registers, and periods when it was minimal. And I wanted to see what represented a sort of break-even point, what information you really did have to have if you were to be able to make a reconstitution that wasn't full of holes, of uncertain linkages. Because the whole thing depends upon developing algorithms that can now be done electronically, linking the vital events that take place in the course of someone's life. And anyway, I got interested in that. Peter Laslett, as you'll know very well, came into it from a different angle. He had, it had struck him from his work on Robert Filmer. He'd initially been largely interested in the history of political theory. He became interested in whether or not Filmer's views about patriarchy were reflected in familial organisation in England at the time, and found in the listings of Clayworth and Cooknoe two places in England where he could examine this with some precision, and as all the world knows, discovered that the small nuclear family constructed very much as small nuclear families are today was as characteristic of 17th century England as of 20th or 21st century England. So he got interested in this, and he too became alert to what was going on in France. And what we jointly felt was that if there was a weakness about the French situation, it was that Henri and his colleagues in INED, the Institut National d'Etudes Démographiques, were doing technically excellent work, but were largely indifferent to historical issues. And others in France, like, say, Pierre Goubert's massive study of the Beauvais de Beauvaisis, were interested in economic and social and familial history, but were not always up to the latest tricks demographically. And there was a degree of hostility between these two camps, I think, in France. And what we were hoping to do was to produce a unit in which there was something like a fusion of the two, which is how it came into existence.
Peter, who was a very great influence also in my life and a dear friend, what was it like working with Peter Laslett?
Well, I'd first come across Peter as an undergraduate because Peter House, when I was in the third year, I think it was my third year, doing the History of Political Thought, Peter House didn't have an internal fellow who taught this, and farmed me out to Peter, who was then a fellow at St John's. He only moved to Trinity later. So I formed links with him then. Mm. He could be very frustrating. He was one of these people who didn't always turn up on time to his supervisions, but like Munir Poston, gave you full value when he was there. And we never collaborated on any particular intellectual project, but we always found a lot of feedback between what he was doing and what I was doing, and the group, I think, provided an ideal forum in which this sort of thing could continue and could draw in a lot of other people as well. We developed a library which I think was unusual in that it not only covered formally published material that was relevant to the work that we and colleagues were doing, but also we made a great effort to include a large number of conference papers and other ephemera. So one of the reasons that it attracted a lot of foreign visitors for many years was to do...
When did Roger Schofield join the group?
Early on. He'd been working...
The Public Record Office,
the PRO, and I think it's fair to say had not... was not attracted towards a formal, a conventional academic life. He was an excellent lecturer, but he wasn't drawn to that aspect of academic life. He was drawn to research, had done very interesting PhD, much later published as a book, but I think could claim to be one of the most quoted unpublished sources of any of the PhDs in this Cambridge University Library, and very rapidly became a triangle rather than duarchy, so to speak. And in particular, he developed an interest not only in the kinds of things I was interested in, but in the history of literacy, and as you'll know, was instrumental in assembling a large mass of very illuminating data about the kinds of people who had acquired at least elementary literacy and how that changed over time. And went on after I had, I think I failed to complete my sort of academic list. When I left LSC in 1988, I went to All Souls, and therefore, although I continued to be in the group frequently, Roger then took over as director and remained so for several years until he in turn was replaced by Richard Smith.
And you then took on quite a lot of extra administrative. You became master of Corpus or Peterhouse?
Corpus.
Corpus, that's right. Did you enjoy being a master of a Cambridge college?
It's one of those things. I know I would have regretted it if I hadn't done it. But I think few people could look back on a mastership and say it was unalloyed pleasure. But it's very instructive also about the nature of people and institutions.
And also you were president of the British Academy.
Yes.
Was that also instructive about human nature? And
I thoroughly enjoyed that. There are awkward cusses at any institution. But I think the Academy has developed into something very different from what it started out as. It's, for example, a little known and I think instructive fact that it makes a larger number of research grants each year than the combined total of grants made by the ESRC and the AHRC. Most of the grants are relatively small, so the sums of money given away are not on the same scale, though quite considerable. But it fulfills for a great many scholars who find difficulty in getting relatively small sums from research councils, a very useful function. It's rather a serious structural problem with research councils that they have indirectly a very great temptation to give money away in large blocks, trivially because it reduces their administrative overheads if they do it that way, but more fundamentally because if you can show a high ratio of alpha-rated applications that are not funded to those that are funded, it strengthens your case for more funding. So that in turn means that you have an indirect incentive to give money away in big blocks, which will ensure that there are plenty of unfunded people, usually funding smaller sums. I'm sounding rather cynical, but I think there is a pressure of that kind. And the Academy has been useful in doing something to alleviate that pressure. And its research fellowships scheme has been, I think, again, hugely successful. And increasingly it's become a voice for for social sciences and the humanities more generally, in a way that can be helpful, and I hope. And my life was greatly, it's very easy to be president when you have as secretary someone like Peter Brown, who's marvellous, I thought.
I've got 2 minutes left, so just 2 minutes on what you're working on now, Tony.
Well, since ceasing to be Master of Corpus, I've been able to go back to what every academic is supposed to do, which is research, and many get frustrated from doing by the other calls on in university life. What I'm working on now, jointly with Lee Shaw Taylor, is a reconstruction of the a history of the changing occupational structure of this country, initially over the period 1750 to 1850, but we hope, well, we will be extending it forward in time to the First World War, and we hope backwards in time, which I think may prove to be the most interesting period of all, the 17th and early 18th centuries, since already many of the patterns that we think of as characteristics of the Industrial Revolution had appeared, as you can see from the occupational structure, by the middle of the 18th century.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed. That was lovely.